Welcome to Akatra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akatra AI. Today, we are undertaking, well, a really fascinating deep dive into one of the most celebrated and frankly complex works of modern historical fiction, Hilary Mantel's Man Booker Prize-winning masterpiece, Wolf Hall. For you, the listener, we're not just looking at a history book here. We're trying to figure out how Mantel managed to, flip centuries of conventional wisdom about a man everyone thought they knew.
That's our mission exactly, Thomas Cromwell. Mm. I mean, for 400 years, he's been pretty much cemented in the English mind as this ruthless Machiavellian schemer. Our source material shows how Mantel really redefined historical fiction. She forces us, the readers, to step entirely inside his mind. And in doing so, she transforms him into this brilliantly complex, profoundly human political genius. She views history not as a string of dates, but, well, as a visceral experience driven by individual consciousness.
And what a visceral start it is. The core narrative charts Cromwell's almost impossible rise. I mean, from the very depths. That violence in his blacksmith father's yard in Putney, straight into the highest echelons of King Henry VIII's court. We're talking about the period between roughly 1500 and 1535, that shocking opening scene, you remember, where young Thomas is literally beaten into the cobblestones?
Yeah.
It's just crucial, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. It doesn't just establish trauma. It establishes the ultimate motivation for survival and, importantly, self-reinvention.
Yeah.
It connects his early powerlessness directly to his later ambition. He learns very quickly, it seems, that the only way to survive a system built on a sort of arbitrary brutality is to control the levers of power yourself. And he steps onto a grand stage of arbitrary brutality, of course. King Henry VIII's desperate need for a male heir. That whole situation everyone calls the king's great matter.
Right. And I was struck by how quickly Henry's, well, personal desire for an annulment from Catherine of Aragon just snowballs into this constitutional earthquake. Because the Pope refuses to grant it, the crisis immediately expands. It's far beyond just one man's marriage bed, isn't it?
It really does. It turns into a world-defining geopolitical standoff. I mean, the Pope can't easily grant the annulment because Catherine's nephew is the most powerful man in Europe, Emperor Charles V. So the refusal forces England to face this existential choice. Do we maintain loyalty to papal authority in the Catholic Church, or do we establish royal supremacy over everything sacred and temporal? And that's the stage where Cromwell's singular genius truly begins to shine.
Okay, so let's unpack maybe the most surprising aspect of the novel, this radical humanization, this revision of these historical giants. Cromwell is the obvious focus, yeah. But what struck me was how Mantel makes his ruthlessness feel almost earned through trauma and grief.
It's the engine of his behavior, arguably. He isn't just a schemer. Mantel shows him as a deeply loyal man whose private life is marked by just devastating loss. You know, he'd lost his wife and daughters to the sweating sickness, which lends this profound sort of melancholic layer to his public ambition. And the fact that he spent years as a soldier, mastering languages, practicing as a lawyer, a merchant, it shows us a man whose political power wasn't just inherited. It was forged, really, in the fire of global commerce and sheer adaptability.
Yeah, self-made in the truest sense. And we see Henry VIII in his prime, too. He's not the later monstrous tyrant figure we often imagine. He's charismatic, intelligent, yes, but also terrifyingly absolute and, underneath it all, deeply insecure. You really feel the weight of expectation on him, that obsessive need for an heir driving the whole political machine.
Absolutely. And Mantel gives Anne Boleyn a similar depth, doesn't she? She's not merely the temptress of legend. No, she's fiercely intelligent, politically astute, very committed to reformist ideals. She understands the power structures, maybe better than many men at court, but she is still fundamentally trapped by the limitations placed on her gender and, well, her ambition.
But where the revision truly becomes fascinating, and let's face it, controversial, is with Sir Thomas More. We're often given the saintly portrait, right? The principled martyr. Mantel gives us a much, much darker image.
She really doesn't pull any punches there, challenging that traditional hagiography. Mantel portrays More as a brilliant man, yes, undoubtedly, but one whose devotion to rigid Catholic orthodoxy makes him, in her telling, a dangerous fanatic. Our sources highlight that his unwavering principle led him to authorize the torture and, yes, execution of those who challenged church doctrine. He saw them as heretics.
Okay, but if we accept Cromwell as this adaptable, sort of sympathetic genius, how does the novel avoid making More just a flat villain, a caricature? Does Mantel let us see any validity in his principled stand, even if he's portrayed as cruel?
She does, I think, subtly. The philosophical tension between them is really the intellectual core of the book. More represents absolute, unyielding doctrine, a man who believes salvation is found in fixed, eternal truth. Cromwell, on the other hand, represents radical pragmatism. He's a man who believes survival and effective governance are maybe the highest goods in a dangerous world. Mantle respects More's conviction, you feel that, but she frames it as rigid and ultimately destructive rigidity, which is itself a powerful critique of absolute certainty in politics, isn't it?
It really is, and bridging these two worlds, these two men, is Cardinal Wolsey. His failure to secure the annulment for Henry is both a cautionary tale and, well, Cromwell's proving ground.
Precisely. Wolsey's disgrace serves as the most powerful lesson for Cromwell. And what actually brings Cromwell to the king's attention, initially with suspicion, is his unwavering, almost defiant loyalty to his disgraced master. That loyalty in a viper pit of courtly treachery suggests to Henry that Cromwell is not only effective, but, crucially, dependable, maybe uniquely dependable. Wolsey's death, whether by illness or a broken heart, it's portrayed as Cromwell losing a mentor, almost a father figure. It confirms the depths of his feeling before he fully launches into the next phase of his career, under the king himself.
Right, and that leads us perfectly into the next part, the architecture of this revolution he engineers. Cromwell moves, really quite swiftly, from being Wolsey's somewhat tainted man to the king's indispensable fixer. His great strength isn't brute force, it's his mind, his ability to see the legal route out of this political maze.
Yes, and what's fascinating is his clarity. While the rest of the court is panicking, trying to appease the Pope or manage the emperor, Cromwell offers the single radical solution. Henry can grant the annulment himself. Why? Because the king is supreme in England. That required not just nerve, but an entirely new constitutional theory. He had to articulate it.
And he doesn't just theorize, he executes. That's the key, isn't it? Cromwell uses Parliament not just as a talking shop, but as a surgical tool, systematically engineering the legal break with Rome.
It's legislative mastery,
yeah,
pure and simple. He's running statutes through Parliament that slowly, piece by piece, dismantle the Pope's authority in England. It all culminates in the big one, the Act of Supremacy of 1534. This act formally declared Henry the supreme head of the Church of England. Cromwell understood the power of drafting law, how words, written correctly, could reshape reality more effectively than any army could.
So this political path, this strategy, inevitably puts him on a collision course with More. It leads to the climax, their psychological duel. Cromwell is tasked with breaking More's resistance, trying to find a legal way to make him comply, even while, personally, you sense he despises More's previous cruelty towards reformers.
It's deeply tragic, that confrontation, and yet politically necessary from Henry's perspective. More refuses to take the oath, recognizing the king's supremacy and, crucially, the legitimacy of Anne's children as heirs. He is ultimately convicted on perjured evidence, which, the novel implies, Cromwell's agents helped procure. It's murky. And the novel forces you, the reader, to confront that ambiguity head on. More's execution is a definitive political victory, securing the new regime, yes, but it is simultaneously a spiritual victory for the martyr, creating a political problem, a symbol that haunts the regime long after.
And the plot resolution leaves Cromwell at the very peak of his power master secretary, but also deeply isolated. There's a kind of somber feeling and inevitability hanging over the ending.
Yes, the novel's final action strongly foreshadows his own future. He visits Wolf Hall, the Seymour family seat, and he notices Jane Seymour. The narrative makes it quite clear that the cycle of ambition, marriage, and destruction is far from over. It's simply turning the next corner. And Cromwell remains firmly lashed to the center of that turning wheel.
Okay, so let's talk a bit about the specific literary craft. What makes this distant history feel so immediate, so internal? It's not just what Mantle writes, but how she writes it.
Exactly. The style itself is revolutionary for historical fiction, really. First, she uses the present tense throughout the entire novel. Now, this is a subtle choice, maybe, but incredibly powerful. History that felt fixed and inevitable suddenly feels contingent, uncertain, urgent. Because for the characters, and for you reading it, it's unfolding right now.
And then there's the famous, some find it challenging, but brilliant use of the pronoun he, because Cromwell is the absolute center. He often refers to him even when other men are in the room. It forces the reader to constantly track the narrative focus and really center Cromwell's experience, his viewpoint.
That centering technique is Mantle's genius move, I think. It places the reader entirely inside Cromwell's consciousness. We're forced to view the world through his calculating, quick-witted, yet, as we've said, deeply human perspective. And it perfectly mirrors the ambiguity of political motivation, doesn't it? Where who is speaking, who is acting, who is thinking is often deliberately obscured in real life, too.
Yeah, that makes sense. And that lens allows Mantle to explore these really complex themes, particularly Cromwell's very modern understanding of power. He knows power doesn't just reside in inherited titles or old stone castles anymore.
That's right. His commercial, his merchant background, it informs his entire worldview. He sees finance, logistics, administration as the true engine of statecraft. Which leads to that memorable quote. The world is run from Antwerp, from Florence, not by the call of the bugle, but by the click of the abacus. He's the modern man, the bureaucrat, stepping into a feudal world.
And this constant need to reinvent himself, born from that early trauma, it touches on the theme of how fluid identity and truth can be. He's always haunted by his past, his father's abuse, Wolsey's ghost, and he recognizes that political action is intrinsically tied to personal memory.
He says it himself, doesn't he? The thing you have to understand about the past is that it's not finished. It's still happening. His legislative brilliance even ties back to this idea. He views law, as we mentioned, not as some dry academic exercise, but as a practical, almost magical mechanism, a way to manifest the king's will and reshape society according to his own pragmatic vision. Remember that other quote?
Which one?
When you are writing laws, you are testing words to find their utmost power. Like spells, they have to make things happen in the real world. That's how he saw it.
Wow. So Wolf Hall ultimately challenges us, the learner, the reader, to look beyond those simple established labels of hero and villain. It forces us to empathize with the pragmatist, the fixer, this man who built his empire on grief and calculation.
Yeah, and I think what the novel ultimately teaches us, or at least asks us to consider, is that when the stakes are absolute survival for a person, or even for a whole nation, those lines between truth and lies, between principle and fanaticism, they're often, well, permeable, like a membrane, as the novel suggests.
Right. So we're left asking, at what precise point does rigid principle become destructive rigidity?
And conversely, at what point does necessary pragmatism become a moral compromise that ends up costing you everything? It's a question with no easy answer.
This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.